Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayen Deng Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Wednesday, June 6, 2018. The new U.S. ambassador to South Sudan denies the United States is looking for regime change in the country.
We want to see peace break out in the country. So we would like to see change in the behavior of the leaders, both in the government and out of the government, in order to aim and achieve that peace. But we're not about regime change per se. We're looking at behavior change and leadership improvements.
And President Kiir agrees to meet with Riek Machar.
They should put South Sudan first and above all, above their personal interests and above the interests of their parties. Secondly, they should move straight to agree to lead the process of reconciliation.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The new U.S. ambassador to South Sudan says the objective of the U.S. policy in South Sudan is not regime change, but for peace to be restored to the country after nearly 4.5 years of fighting. Speaking in an exclusive interview with South Sudan in Focus, Ambassador Tom Hushek tells Charlton Doki in Juba that the U.S. wants to see an end to violence and to support the people of South Sudan.
My priority, as it has been for the American embassy over time and for decades here in southern Sudan and South Sudan since independence, is to support the people in their dreams of peace, security, and prosperity. We will also, of course, continue to play a leading role as a provider of humanitarian assistance and to support human rights and democracy in the country.
Some top government officials here have accused the U.S. government of wanting a regime change in this country. What's your comment?
The United States, of course, does want to see some changes in the country here. And again, those are the changes I mentioned at the beginning. We want to see peace break out in the country. So we would like to see change in the behavior of the leaders, both in the government and out of the government, in order to aim and achieve that peace. But we're not about regime change per se. We're looking at behavior change and leadership improvements.
Why is the U.S. focusing on sanctions as a way to push forward the peace process?
Our strategy here is to again, achieve peace. So we are using some pressure techniques on that front, and we're also using some positive levers, if you will. So, yes, we are using sanctions and other methods to make sure that there are strong incentives for the leaders in the government and the opposition to come and participate genuinely in the peace process. On the positive side, we're very much about engagement. The Washington sending a new ambassador here is one sign of that engagement. And also my intention will be to engage as much as I can with the people of South Sudan here in the capital, out and around the country. And because of the humanitarian situation here, I'll be engaging, I hope, with South Sudanese who are in exile or in the diaspora or in refugee situations overseas. And then, of course, we will continue, as I mentioned, to be a big provider and backer of humanitarian assistance, as long as it's not contributing or fueling the crisis or the conflict. And that's another form of engagement in our commitment to the people of South Sudan.
What's going to be the U.S. government's next course of action if the U.N. Security Council does not vote in favor of sanctions on the 6 individuals who were identified recently as blocking the road to peace?
Well, you know, as you mentioned, the United States has imposed some sanctions and other pressure points over the last several months. Our aim would be to multilateralize as much of that as possible and to ensure that others in the international community take similar steps or steps together. That's why, ideally, UN sanctions are always more viable and more beneficial in a situation like this. But we will continue to push for that multilateralizing of the pressure points, But we will, of course, continue also to pursue these directly if we do not win the day in the discussions in the United Nations or in our discussions with African neighbors in the African Union or IGAD.
Besides additional sanctions, which of course include asset freezes and travel bans on some of the leaders, are there other consequences that violators of the peace agreement and individuals who are accused of crimes, you know, such as human rights abuses, are there other consequences that these individuals are likely to face if the parties do not reach a peace deal?
Well, there are a very large range of tools that we can use, or more importantly, that South Sudanese will avail themselves of in years to come. The things that have been mostly in the news lately, the sanctions, our push for an arms embargo, the listings of entities in the petroleum sector here in our export regime, those things are usually what people are considering as far as sanctions. But we also, remember, have on the table an entire body of international practice that is becoming deeper and more refined, that has to do with bringing accountability to for gross violations of human rights, for example. And a lot of this will be in the purview of an international community, because these are matters of international norm and international human rights law and the law of war. But also a lot of it will be in the hands of the South Sudanese people. You know, how do they want to pursue justice into the future? Those are things that we, of course, comment on, and we can provide some expertise and assistance. But a lot of that will be in the hands of citizens and your listeners. One of the chapters of that peace agreement, of course, includes tools for accountability and reconciliation. Those should still be very much actively considered. There is a particular issue to push for the establishment of an African Union hybrid court, and that the work on that has proceeded quite a ways, but so far the government of South Sudan has withheld its approval for that, and we really encourage that to be finalized and put in place.
That was U.S. Ambassador to South Sudan Tom Hushek speaking to reporter and editor Charlton Doki in Juba. Tomorrow, Ambassador Hushek describes in detail the U.S. mission in South Sudan. President Salva Kiir has confirmed his willingness to meet with rebel leader Riek Machar in an effort to resolve outstanding issues that the warring parties have failed to agree on in order to reach a peace deal. Acting Foreign Minister Martin Elia Lomero told reporters that Sudan President Omar al-Bashir has offered to host talks between Kiir and Machar in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Sudanese Foreign Minister Al-Dirdir Mohamed Ahmed recently led a Sudanese delegation to Juba to discuss a meeting between President Kiir and Machar. Ahmed told reporters after meeting with President Kiir that he delivered President Bashir's message to President Kiir regarding arrangements of the meeting between the two South Sudanese leaders.
Mr. Bashir is proposing an initiative to bring together his two brothers, Salva Kiir Mayardit and Dr. Riek Machar, in Khartoum soon. President Kiir has welcomed and accepted the idea of arranging a meeting between him and Riek Machar in order to restore peace and stability in South Sudan.
Ahmed was accompanied by the Sudanese Minister of Oil and Gas, Azari Abdulgader Abdullahi, and Director of the Sudan's National Security and Intelligence Agency, Salah Abdullahi Goss, as well as a number of other top Sudanese officials. South Sudanese Acting Foreign Affairs Minister Martin Elia Lomuro confirms President Kiir is ready to meet with Machar in Khartoum.
The president has warmly received the invitation and the initiative and have agreed that this be taken forward.
The meeting between Kiir and Machar was in a resolution passed by IGAD Council of Ministers meeting held last week in Addis Ababa. IGAD wants Kiir and Machar to tackle contentious issues that their delegations have failed to resolve following several rounds of talks in Addis Ababa. Mabior Garang, the SPLM-IO chairperson for communication, says Machar is willing to meet with Kiir, but says his movement is not aware of any official communication on a venue for the meeting. In a statement released this evening, Mabior says, quote, the SPLM-SPLAIO chairman and commander-in-chief, Riek Machar, is more than happy to meet with President Salva Kiir in any IGAD country, including Ethiopia, Kenya, and Uganda, or any country outside the region, including Mauritania, end of quote. South Sudanese activists have broadly welcomed the initiative for the meeting of the two leaders, saying they are the key principals in the conflict and they expect them to strike deals on a number of areas in the revitalization forum. Jame David Kolok, Executive Director for Foundation for Democracy and Accountable Governance of FODAC, says the two leaders need to build confidence between their two sides to ensure that the talks move forward. He says the two leaders must also ensure the two sides observe the cessation of hostilities agreement signed last December.
The kind of negative propaganda that emanated from the responsibility sharing in terms of who takes which position should be able to be harmonized, and that they should be able to rise above their self and put the country first. We expect that actually at the end of this meeting there must be some level of a package which is a gift to the people of South Sudan, and we are looking at the possibility of responses like, okay, enough is enough.
Activist Rajab Mohandis says the Kiir Machar meeting is long overdue and describes the development as positive move. He says the two leaders should set aside their personal and party interests and resolve the outstanding issues.
They should put South Sudan first and above all, above their personal interests and above the interests of their parties. Secondly, they should move straight to agree to lead the process of reconciliation, that is popularizing the discussions in Addis, and hopefully an agreement that will be signed as a revitalized agreement, that they should start to popularize that it is their initiative as leaders of the different parties to pursue this process in order to restore peace in our country. And we also expect them to discuss some of the contentious issues, especially on transitional governance arrangements and transitional security arrangements, issues that have not been fully agreed upon by their delegations in Addis.
The date for the two leaders' meeting has yet to be set, but a recent IGAD communique encourages the two leaders to meet before July. This will be the first time the two leaders have met since Machar fled Juba in July 2016, when fighting flared up between Machar's bodyguards and the South Sudan Army. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
A top aid official visiting South Sudan says the country's worst case of hunger is looming, as more civilians in more places have nothing to eat than ever before in the history of South Sudan. The Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council says an upsurge in fighting, especially in parts of Unity State, has meant that humanitarian workers cannot access the needy. Dimo Silva Aurelio has this report for VOA from Juba.
Norwegian Refugee Council Secretary General Jane Egeland just wrapped up a 3-day visit to South Sudan. He says more people in South Sudan stand the risk of going hungry in the next 2 months.
Today I am more worried than I've been ever since this young nation was born, in terms of more people in higher needs of food assistance than ever before in the years that I can recall of South Sudan. We have a Herculean effort before us if we are to avert people starving.
Food security experts warned in February that unless aid and access were maintained, 7.1 million South Sudanese would face crisis or worse, acute food insecurity between May and July. That is 2 out of every 3 people in South Sudan. Eglant says an upsurge in fighting, lack of access and attacks on aid workers have made things worse for the already food insecure communities across the country. He says much of former Unity State and the Equatorial States have become humanitarian black holes where access to communities is almost completely blocked.
We still do not have access in a number of areas, including in Unity State, where we were in the Equatorias and elsewhere. We need security for relief workers. 100 colleagues have died since December 2013. But more than anything, we need peace. We need an end to the violence against civilians.
Eglant says as South Sudan's warring parties come under more international pressure to reach a peace agreement, humanitarian partners and donors must deliver more assistance to people who need it in South Sudan.
This is not the time to lower our investment in reaching humanitarian goals in South Sudan. This is the time where we scale up. The same time as there is more pressure on those men with guns and power who can make peace, who should make peace, and who must protect the civilian population.
The UN says in April there were 80 reported incidents in which aid workers were prevented from delivering aid. In May, the Norwegian Refugee Council was forced to suspend an emergency food distribution in Unity State when the agency's compound came under attack. Adnan Khan is the UN's World Food Programme Country Director and the Acting Humanitarian Coordinator in South Sudan.
The humanitarian situation in South Sudan continues to deteriorate. An unprecedented 7 million people will depend on humanitarian assistance in 2018.
Khan says 80% of the total money needed to carry out South Sudan's humanitarian response plan has not been met.
Our humanitarian response plan, which is of the tune of 1.7 billion, is funded only at 20% level at this stage. That means that we only have $1 out of every $5 that we need to meet the needs of all our beneficiaries.
Since February's warning, large parts of South Sudan have seen an uptick in violence. Renewed fighting in parts of Unity State in April displaced thousands of civilians, and thousands more were forced from their homes in the Equatorial region. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America. Mobile service contractors are gunned down in South Sudan. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what's one thing do you like best about yourself?
Wow. The best thing I like in myself is that when I believe in what I'm doing, nobody can change it. And when I say this is where I'm heading to, nobody can change it. If I already made up my mind that this is it, so that is it. Nobody can change what I have in my mind.
I love smiling. It hides everything. You can never tell when I'm sad. You can never tell when I'm happy. So I smile a lot to bring out the best in me.
I'm a pencil artist. I can draw. I grew up doing that in primary school, and I perfected doing that. So I can draw you, and I can also, I like music, so I play guitar.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. South African-owned mobile phone company MTN is condemning the killing of two of its contractors in South Sudan on Monday. MTN's head of dispute management at the company says South Sudanese authorities must beef up security so workers for companies like MTN can continue to do their jobs in remote parts of the country. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Juba.
MTN engineer Abu Obeida Muhammad Tuba and his driver Moses Ozie were both shot dead while traveling on the Torit Kapoita Road 2 days ago. The slain MTN contractors were restoring mobile services in the area after being down for more than a year. MTN contractor Angelo Gina John survived the attack and recovering from a gunshot wound at the left shoulder. He tells South Sudan in Focus there were three unidentified gunmen wearing civilian clothes. Speaking in Arabic, from the South Sudan hospital in Juba today, Gina describes what happened.
After we finished our work at the site, we departed towards the town, and at a distance of 100 meters, three armed men appeared in front of our car, and immediately they shot our driver on his chest. They also shot me on my left shoulder as I was seated behind the driver. One of them came and pushed the dead driver aside and started driving the car.
Gina says the attackers shot at their car, killing his two colleagues and wounded him. He says the attackers then took over the car and started driving towards Tori town. He says after driving for more than an hour, one of the three armed men turned to him and asked him to get out of the car and run into the bush.
I kept on running towards Lobira Mountain because I was afraid they might come after me. I was bleeding so much and I had to rest under a tree. But after some time, I decided to go towards the main road, and I heard a sound of a vehicle, and I saw armed men, and I waved at them to stop, and I told them about the incident.
Stephen James Hakim, MTN's head of disputes management, condemned the attack.
Those people are innocent. We are sending them there not to go and doing something wrong, but they are going to make the life of the people on the ground easy because communication is more important. But if such people who is helping people and then you kill them, which means I can see the future for development of this country will be hard for us.
Hakim says morale among MTN employees is down in the aftermath of the attack.
If the morale is down, they cannot deliver. If they cannot deliver, some of site will not be on air because they will be afraid if they go there, what happened to their colleague, it will happen to them.
Hakim is calling on the government to ensure the safety of MTN staff whenever they venture out into the remote communities across the country.
We want to see that there is a peace on the ground. We want to see that such people should be brought to book and then punished for their criminal act so they will feel there is a justice is taking place, because such things should not go easily like that. So at least to bring hope to some of engineers.
The MTN telecommunications company has more than 300 networks posters across the country, but Hakim estimates only about 200 out of them are operational due to the country's insecurity. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
Some South Sudanese church leaders in Australia say they are alarmed by the number of young South Sudanese detained in several Australian prisons. Reverend Deacon George Piet Meat is the chaplain of the South Sudanese community in Dandagan. He says the Catholic Church is ready to help convicted South Sudanese youth to start a new life after serving their jail terms. He says cultural differences are to blame for the challenges facing a lot of young South Sudanese living in Australia.
Some of these young people, they came from Egypt and from Kenya and Uganda and all this. So when they arrived here, they put them into a school according to their age. You know, going to school with the children who started the school from prep here, some of them, they find it very difficult to, you know, dealing with the school. And then very high expectation from the parents that we want them to have a better education. When they go to school, they find it very difficult. And then they just left their school and then, you know, make wrong choices. And now they are causing all this bad behavior. And now the community image has been damaged also by the media here, always talking negative about the community. So this is why now we have a lot of young people in the prison.
Is there any rough figure of how many young South Sudanese in prisons across Australia? I know it's not easy to get that number, but is the church having any rough figure?
You know, because of the privacy here, we don't have rough numbers because of this privacy. But when we talk to the prison authorities, they always give us that there are a lot of young people, but majority of them are South Sudanese. So which means it giving us a sign that there are a lot of them.
Churches are given privileges to visit prisons, to pray with prisoners. Have you ever had an opportunity to visit one prison and meet some of these young South Sudanese? And what are they telling you?
Through the Catholic prison chaplaincy, we establish a visiting group. They are mainly mothers. So they go on Sunday. There is one group on Sunday and one group on Tuesday. We go there and pray with them. But it is a very limited time, John. So because they come out, they attended the Mass. And after Mass, we have just a little time with them to engage with them. But now an opportunity came up that we're going to establish a community visit. And this community visit will give more time. And this will be a particular program. It's not like, you know, a church visit. So it will be a community visit. And this will give a community chance to talk to them and to know their issues, to prepare them and also to reconnect them with the families and also with, you know, with the community.
What are their families telling you? Because, you know, having your child in prison is not easy. What are parents telling you?
The parents are, they are in a very, very, very hard situation. We are living in a country where there is a privacy. Some of these kids, because they feel that, you know, they let their family down and they feel ashamed. Sometimes when they go to prison, they put down that I don't want to be visited even by my own parents. When these parents approach us, you know, through the church, they cry, and sometimes this is where we reconnect them. We reconnect them back with their families. So it is a very, very, you know, very difficult situation, John.
There is no explanation of why these kids are on the streets. What do you think is the root cause of the problem?
I think the media, to be honest, the media is damaging the community, is talking negative things against the community. There are good things happening in the community. Even some young people are now doing very well. We have, you know, good number in sport, Australian football, and also, but these kids, because of these cultural, you know, differences, and also joining the wrong group, and also, they don't listen to their parents, and I don't know what is the problem, but the discipline here is not like in our country. So most of these kids, most of them are not living with their, you know, with their parents. They are taken from their parents by the Department of Child Services. When the child is taken out from the parents, you don't have right again.
When a child is taken from parents, it's my understanding that there could be a problem, for instance, parental negligence could result into the government taking over your child. Is that the case here in Australia?
Most of this issue is because, you know, some of these kids, they misinterpret the word of having a freedom, that I need my freedom. And this is where, you know, now we find ourselves now. No, the family hierarchy, you have to stay home. You are not a child. You are not an adult yet. But this is where, you know, when they say, no, I don't want to live in the house, this is when, you know, the problem starts.
That's Reverend Deacon George Pietsch Meat, chaplain of the South Sudanese Catholic community at St. Mary's Parish in Dandenong, Melbourne. He was speaking with my colleague John Tanza from the Australian city of Melbourne earlier today. And that's our show for this Tuesday. We leave you with the song Maka by Abdulrahman Abdullah. That was a taste of Abdulrahman Abdullah with the song Makafa. I'm Ayan Dengbior in Washington. Thank you for allowing us into your homes and vehicles. Let us know how you liked the show. You can find us on the web at southsudan@voanews.com or reach us on Facebook. Our title is South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. يا جديا شاغلنا يا ما يا حبب ما شعنا دام يا دعاش حق الوسامة.